Welcome to the deep dive. We take listener-provided information and really try to extract what you need to understand.
Exactly.
So today, our focus comes from a listener who's really involved with the Think and Act Locally podcast.
Oh, right. The one serving Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena. Great resource.
Absolutely. They focus on empowering residents right there in Southeast Houston, giving them information to, you know, make a difference locally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the case we're diving into today happened outside that specific area. But the issues it brings up, well, they feel relevant. Issues about the legal system, fairness, things anyone invested in their community cares about.
Definitely. So our listener pointed us towards the Free Mark Lasher website.
Right.
It details the case of Mark Anthony Lasher. He was convicted back in June 2002, Leon County, Texas, for a sexual offense.
Okay.
And just to be clear, our goal here isn't to retry the case or anything like that.
No, no.
We're exploring what the website presents, looking for those key aspects, potential concerns, maybe broader insights that would resonate with, well, anyone interested in community well-being and justice. Think of it as examining potential system vulnerabilities.
Got it. So the website kicks off with a case background. It states Lasher's conviction in 2002 rested entirely on testimony described as contradictory, unsubstantiated, and, well, changing.
And they make a strong point right away. Zero physical evidence presented by the prosecution to back up the claims of repeated sexual assault.
None.
Okay.
And there's a specific point about the initial report timeline.
Yeah, this is striking. The alleged victim's aunt testified the disclosure happened on November 25th, 2000, leading to CPS involvement.
Right.
But, and this seems crucial according to the site, the alleged victim, AG, had already been removed from her home by CPS 5 days earlier, on November 20th.
Wait, so she was already in CPS custody before the date the aunt says she disclosed, and also before the date the final assault allegedly happened, November 25th.
That's exactly the timeline presented on the website. It raises a fundamental question about the sequence of events the prosecution relied on.
That seems incredibly significant, if she wasn't even in the home.
Yeah.
Okay. The site also mentions videotaped interviews.
Yes. These were apparently key evidence. But crucially, they were presented via written interrogatories.
Meaning no live cross-examination. The defense couldn't ask questions in real time.
Precisely. They couldn't probe inconsistencies or gauge demeanor directly. The prosecution argued AG was too traumatized, PTSD, nightmares, hallucinations to testify live.
But that lack of direct confrontation is a major aspect of due process, isn't it? That right to face your accuser.
It's a cornerstone. Limiting cross-examination like that significantly hampers the defense's ability to test the testimony's validity.
Okay, so moving into the trial itself, the website raises several concerns. First up, jury selection. Flaws? Potential bias?
Yeah, they mention one juror apparently admitting bias just based on hearing the accusation. And another who seemed to misunderstand the burden of proof, saying something like, if you prove he's innocent, then I'm all for it.
Which completely flips the standard,
yeah.
Right? Innocent until proven guilty.
Exactly. The website argues the defense didn't adequately challenge these jurors at the time.
That's a huge issue if true. An impartial jury is fundamental.
Absolutely. Then there's the point we touched on, the complete lack of forensic evidence.
Right. The medical exam 6 days after the alleged final incident. A nurse practitioner, Jane Riley, testified. No physical signs of abuse, no trauma, tearing, abrasions, nothing.
And the prosecution's response, according to the site, was basically suggesting that wasn't significant because children can heal quickly.
But zero findings so soon after alleged repeated incidents. That's a detail the website really emphasizes.
It's certainly a point that stands out in their narrative.
And again, they hammer home the cross-examination issue, the Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses. Using only videos and written questions, they argue, violated that fundamental right. Practically, what does that mean for a defense team?
Well, you lose spontaneity. You can't react instantly to an answer, ask a follow-up you didn't anticipate. You can't see how the witness reacts under direct questioning. It's a much more limited, less effective way to challenge testimony.
Okay. And the website revisits the timeline issue again, framing it as a failure to establish key legal elements.
Right. Reiterating that the alleged abuse time frame, Thanksgiving, November 23rd to Saturday, November 25th, happened after AG was removed from the home on November 20th and was in CPS custody.
With the aunt's outcry also on that Saturday the 25th, it just seems like a direct factual contradiction based on their presentation.
If the timeline presented by the prosecution doesn't match the known facts of the alleged victim's location, it fundamentally undermines the accusation's basis.
Then there are inconsistencies noted in the accuser's statements over time.
Yes. The website claims the initial accusations were against her parents and grandfather.
Okay.
Mark Lasher's name, they say, only came up later, after repeated questioning while she was in CPS custody. And there's another layer. Her sister apparently also made an accusation initially, but later formally recanted it, saying it wasn't true.
That adds complexity, suggesting potential confusion or outside influence, perhaps.
It certainly raises questions about the reliability and evolution of the accusations, at least according to the website's narrative.
The site also alleges the prosecution used emotion over evidence.
Yeah, suggesting that skepticism was portrayed as hurting the child, pressuring jurors towards a guilty verdict based on feelings rather than just facts.
Which ideally isn't how it should work. Verdicts need to be based on proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's the standard. Emotion is powerful, but evidence should be paramount.
And finally, regarding the trial phase, they mention alleged law enforcement bias, specifically during sentencing.
Right. Texas Ranger Jim Huggins testified about Lasher having a bad reputation.
Okay.
But Huggins apparently admitted he'd never even met Lasher before the arrest, so the testimony was based entirely on hearsay or opinion, not personal knowledge.
And the argument is that this kind of opinion-based testimony unfairly influenced the sentence.
That's the claim. Reputation testimony has rules, and introducing opinions from someone with no direct knowledge can be seen as prejudicial.
Okay, so that covers the trial concerns. Now, the website shifts to more recent events, potential new evidence. This seems to center on alleged recantation attempts by the accuser.
Yes, and they lay out a pretty detailed timeline. It apparently starts back in 2011, when Lasher reportedly first heard about a possible recantation.
2011, okay.
Then, skipping ahead, 2018, the accuser allegedly contacts Lasher's brother via Facebook, sort of informally recanting. There's apparently photo evidence of this exchange.
Mm, yeah.
2022. She allegedly messages Lasher directly through the JPay prison system, though he didn't become aware until 2023.
So contact is being made.
Seems so. July 2023, she reportedly registers her phone number with TDCJ, the Texas prison system, August 2023. Communication starts, calls, e-messages. She also contacted the Actual Innocence Clinic at UT.
The Actual Innocence Clinic got involved.
And then October 2023, a two-hour in-person visit at the prison unit. The website even has a photo from this visit.
An in-person visit, wow.
Yeah.
That suggests something significant was happening.
It certainly implies a level of direct engagement. Following this, November 2023, an attorney from that Actual Innocence Clinic agrees to represent Lasher.
Based on this potential new evidence and contact.
Presumably. But then things take a turn. January 2024, the attorney gets the old forensic interview videos. The accuser watches them.
Okay.
And by February 2024, according to the site, she speaks to the attorney and says she's no longer willing to pursue formal legal exoneration.
Why the change?
The site says she cited re-triggered memories, increased anxiety. Essentially, the trauma of revisiting it was too much.
That's understandable. Incredibly complex emotionally.
Very. But interestingly, the website states she did remain willing to advocate for his parole.
So not full exoneration, but support for release via parole. That's nuanced.
Deeply nuanced. Mm-hmm. It shows how complex these situations involving past trauma can be.
The site also mentions other potential evidence.
Yeah.
Recorded calls, texts.
Yes. They state there are recorded TDCJ phone calls where the accuser allegedly gives more details about being coerced into the original accusations.
Coerced.
That's the allegation. And also multiple text messages purportedly sent by her to friends and family affirming Lasher's innocence and her desire to help overturn the conviction.
If those calls and texts exist and say what the website claims, that could be very significant evidence.
Absolutely. Corroborating evidence of a recantation, especially with details of alleged coercion, would likely demand serious legal reevaluation.
Beyond the legal case itself, the website also gives some background on Mark Lasher during his incarceration.
Right. It paints a picture of someone trying to be productive, mentions he got his GED, scored really well, top 2% in the state.
Impressive.
And completed a lot of programs. Leadership Academy, cognitive intervention, practical skills like bricklaying, theology courses, Bible studies.
So focusing on education and personal growth.
Seems like it. They also highlight ongoing involvement in ministry and mentoring other inmates, teaching Christian principles practically.
And they include some personal details, too. Music, movies,
Yeah, just a few things to sort of humanize him, maybe. Mentions liking bands like Cage the Elephant, Chevelle, movies like Dune, Gladiator, games like Zelda.
Just adding a bit of dimension beyond the case details.
Exactly. And they note he expresses plans to continue mentoring others if he's eventually released. For the Think and Act Locally audience interested in rehabilitation and community support, that might be a relevant point.
Okay, so finally, the website wraps up with a call to action. What are they asking people to do?
Well, the main goal stated is raising awareness and funds for his legal
Makes
defense.
sense.
They list ways to help, donate for legal costs, investigation, advocacy, spread the word online using their hashtags, hashtag free Mark Lasher, hashtag wrongful conviction.
Standard awareness campaign stuff.
Right. Also suggesting people contact officials, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the state attorney general. And for those with skills, they mention volunteering legal or research help or joining their advocacy network.
So, trying to build a support base.
Seems so. They provide contact info for writing to him directly or registering for phone calls, and they briefly mention another case they support under a Support Justice Today section, a Richard Collins case.
Okay, so a platform for awareness, funding, and mobilization.
That sums it up.
All right, so let's try to pull this all together,
Oh.
based purely on the free Mark Lasher website that our listener shared.
Uh-huh.
We have a 2002 conviction based, they say, solely on testimony, no physical evidence.
Right, with major questions raised about the trial itself, jury selection issues, the inability to cross-examine the accuser directly.
The timeline discrepancy seems huge. The alleged events happening after the accuser was removed from the home.
Plus, the inconsistencies noted in the accuser's statements over time and allegations of emotional appeals and biased testimony influencing the outcome and sentence.
And then, layered on top of all that, are these more recent alleged recantations and communications, adding a whole new level of complexity.
Exactly. And bringing it back to you, our listener connected with Think and Act Locally. Think about this. This case isn't in Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena.
Right.
But the core issues due process, the possibility of mistakes or injustice in the system, the power of community awareness and advocacy, these are relevant everywhere. Understanding potential flaws, even in distant cases, helps us appreciate the importance of vigilance and fairness in our own local justice systems.
That's a really powerful connection. How does digging into a complex, possibly troubling case like this one, even though it's geographically removed, inform how we view justice and fairness right here in our own neighborhoods? Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena. What role can we play locally, informed by these broader concerns, to ensure our own systems are as fair and accountable as possible, to perhaps prevent similar potential miscarriages of justice close to home? Definitely something to reflect on.